This is CliffCentral.com.
It's just after 7 o'clock, CliffCentral.com. This is brought to you by Nando's. Almost as spicy as Canton Pillay this morning with his gift for Pumi for her birthday. So much to get into, and you guys are going to fill me in because I've actually been out of the news loop for the last 5 or 6 days. I did see that there are all kinds of revelations regarding Pravin Gordhan and the public protector, Busisiwe Mkhwebane, which have come to light lately. So who knows the story the best and who can fill me in and hopefully all the rest of us who are not sure what's going on? Do you know what's happening here, Pumi?
So boring.
Is it boring?
So I think that it is boring because I think that there's so much, it's so distracting. There's so much going on. So a week, was it on Friday or the week before?
Mm-hmm.
Out of the starting blocks first comes Busisiwe Mkhwebane, the public protector, with her YouTube channel, because Stratcom is not reporting on all of the things that she is putting out there. And she has her, finally has her report on...
Can I just ask, is this woman totally mentally healthy?
Rogue unit.
Because
there are
perfectly good government communication services which she's entitled to use, and she's got plenty of other ways of getting her message out there. What is this?
Yeah,
what unconventional nonsense is this?
There's good government communication services. Wait.
Oh, sorry.
When did I miss this?
Okay.
Gareth,
I consider myself reprimanded.
What you also missed last week is the issue of manufactured outrage, which is something that South Africans are being shepherded into this outrage of all sorts of things. So that's what she's doing, right? She's also manufacturing outrage for herself.
What was her
outrage?
So
she comes out. Yeah? She comes out with her report on, surprise, surprise, Pravin Gordhan and the so-called rogue unit. Depending on who you're asking, is it rogue, is it rouge? But anyway, the rogue unit at SARS.
Well, first of
and then, you know, was it actually, did Nugent say this doesn't exist? Was there a rogue unit? Is there such a thing? Was Pravin right? Was Pravin wrong? All of that. And then 30 days for the president to act on her findings, because this is what the president must act within 30 days. So,
except for
3 days later.
Let's go back to the Nugent Commission, which found that the establishment of the NRG was lawful. And let's stop calling it a rogue unit. This was a term that was coined by the Sunday Times in order to put a particular spin on it.
And the
Sunday Times apologized for it.
They were led by the nose in this story,
yes.
And it was an embarrassment to the Sunday Times. It kind of revealed them as fake news.
Exactly.
That they were willing to believe any story they were told by people who were planted to...
Well, they didn't follow journalistic processes.
Correct.
Because they were so anxious to actually get the story
right
out there. And, you know, the whole suggestion was that Zuma's office had been bugged was the first lie that came out.
Yeah, we've heard that before. Remember the spy tapes as well?
Yes, well...
which we also found out was nonsense. And yet people are not suspicious when they hear stories like this.
Well, the crucial thing right now in this whole Pravin versus the Public Protector Act is you have to go back to the Nugent Commission, which said that it was lawful.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, the Public Protector's findings is fundamentally flawed because she insists on calling it a rogue unit and she says it was unlawfully established. She is, however, taking the view that the Nugent Commission is not a court of law and therefore, she's able to ride roughshod over it.
But it is allowed. I mean, what we've discovered subsequently is that this thing was constituted well within the rights of SARS. They are able to do these investigations. And they can technically spy on anyone they are. I mean, SARS's powers are wide ranging.
Yes.
They can get into your bank account, right?
Exactly, and they can take out money whenever they want to, and that's the nature of the beast for every tax authority around the world.
So what is particularly fascinating is also the clever wording around all of these things, because so as Catherine says, so she comes out to say, actually, the Nugent Commission is not a law body as such. It's just a commission.
We
have different powers than Nugent. But also she comes out to say, well, you know, so they were allowed maybe to create this, but what they should have done is they should have had an MOU and allowed the NIA, right? the National Intelligence Agency to be the ones that run this thing, because this is how it's supposed to be. How it's supposed to be is SARS is not supposed to constitute this thing. SARS is supposed to say we require such a thing, and the NIA within its gambit is supposed to be the ones that do this. So then it's a whole thing, right? But it's fascinating to see who is, and that's why I think it's manufacturing outrage for South Africans, because you've got to kind of
let me have all of let's these cut words. Out because this sounds like, as you say, Pumi, it's manufactured. Doesn't Busisiwe Mqwebane realize that at some point she is the only one pedaling a bicycle that all the others have jumped off of already? She's like the lone survivor of a cult. You know, when everyone commits suicide because the comet's coming over, and she's the one left alive, and so she continues to believe in the cult even though everyone else is gone.
Well, it's actually been very useful for the Zuma forces from the point of view that she continues to be a huge disruptor in terms of any plan on the part of Cyril to be able to actually firmly take hold of the reins of government. So every time there is an opportunity to actually start doing things, that's the point at which you suddenly see the public protector releasing something else that is now imposing a decision that says basically to the president, you will do the following things by the following time. And again, the constitutionality of that actually has to be tested, because remedial action can be imposed by the public protector, but at the same time, the processes that need to be in place. And we saw examples of this when she tried to say the remedial action that I am proposing is that the mandate of the South African Reserve Bank must be changed. And that's clearly rubbish, because there's the constitutional prerogative in terms of how the Reserve Bank is actually operating. Again, in the case of the president, you know, can one simply tell the president, my remedial action is that you should declare war on Zimbabwe? I don't think so.
No.
So,
but it's weird. This is almost like a perversion. It's a direct inversion of the situation we had when Thuli Madonsela was Jacob Zuma's public protector, because we were all on her side firmly in terms of what she was finding, which was uncomfortable.
I don't think that one could actually accuse Madonsela at any given stage of trying to undermine constitutional processes. So if you consider that her final state capture report, the state of capture report, did not say, here are my findings and I propose remedial action. In fact, what she said was that I'm unable to take this thing further in the time that's available to me, and the action that I'm proposing is that the president must institute a commission that is going to investigate these things and take it further, which is in fact the appropriate thing to do.
No, but that's why I say it's an inverted situation compared to what we have now. Not only is Busisiwe Mqwebane perhaps pushing the limits of her own power, but she's also doing bidding of the very faction that Thuli Madonsela revealed was trying to undermine the state.
Yes. And I think the crucial thing right now is, look, Ramaphosa's actually got an opportunity. And the opportunity really is that the ANC has to propose that the public protector is unfit for office. Obviously, the EFF is going to vote against that. But guess what? The DA will vote for it, because the woman is a loose cannon.
Loose cannon. She's a nutcase. She's clearly like out of her depth as well. And remember, when she came in as public protector, there were a couple of other options. There were some very good candidates. And for some bizarre reason, she floated to the top. And we can now see that...
Well, the reason why she floated to the top is because she was black.
Is that it?
Yes.
That was all?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, if I had to have a choice in terms of candidates at the time, I would have preferred Judge Siraj Desai, who had put his name forward.
Absolutely.
Yes. And
but that's because you would only choose an Indian, of course, because that's how you are.
Well, actually, I think he's considered to be Cape Coloured, but, you know, we're okay there.
Yeah, but you see what I mean?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like, this is where it gets you eventually. Yes. If you only think in terms of race, then this is what you end up with.
Yeah, if you look at Siraj Desai's track record in terms of the judgments that he's handed down over the years, and they've been, you know, things that have set major precedents in terms of, you know, drawing the line between rule of law and very firmly on the side of human rights, which is where I think public protectors need to be.
Yeah.
So, but look, on the issue again of public outrage, because all of these things, we hear what we hear depending on what you're reading, what you're listening to, and all of that kind of stuff. I found very fascinating to see last night all of the stuff that was being reported by EWN, obviously, because last night, Pravin's responding affidavit, well, it's not his responding affidavit, he actually put in an urgent interdict against, obviously, against Cyril Ramaphosa, because now he's got this 30-day ticking time clock that says he's got to do something within 30 days. So Pravin puts out his in South Gauteng High Court, right? And then, so EWN is running a thread, doing quite a lot of kind of back-checking on how irrational is Busisiwe Mkhwebane, how crazy. She's been in the office since what? Since 2016? Since October 2016 or whatever? So then they run a whole thing around all of the judgments and all of the reports that she's put out in her tenure. So in the 2 years that she's been out there, some 700 reports she's put out. And of those 700, only 30% of them are currently being reviewed, which is, okay, fascinating, right? Seven reports have been set aside on grounds of irrationality and unreasonableness by courts.
Only seven out of?
700.
Wow.
But hold on. Of these seven that have been put aside on the grounds of irrationality and unreasonableness, only two of them are reports that she put out. So of the seven that have been set aside because they are unreasonable, five of them belong to Thuli Madonsela.
Hmm. What do we think of that?
I need more details.
Okay.
Yes. Ultimately, what if there are 700 reports that are being put through, let's be very clear that she has not personally been involved in 700 reports.
Yes, of course.
So the fact that, you know, particular reports happen under particular people's tenure.
She seems to be making a lot of noise about some of these reports rather than others.
Exactly. So it's clear that they have her attention. But there's an interesting piece, by the way, News 24, written by Kyle Cullen, who was doing a comparison between the public protector Mkhwebane's findings and the charge sheet, the trumped-up charge sheet against Ivan Pillay and others that was, you know, subsequently dropped. And it looks, and the News 24 report actually presents that charge sheet with Mkhwebane's report side by side. And certainly to my eye, it looks like she's done a copy and paste from that charge sheet and inserted it into her findings.
You know, when something's been as discredited as that was, you really have to be either extremely stubborn or you're working for someone else, patently working for someone else, in order to get something revived which is dead. And that's what's obviously going on here. So I think her credibility is at an all-time low, and I wouldn't be surprised if something quite drastic happens in that office in the next couple of weeks. Let's turn our attention to something I would really like to have your thoughts on this morning. We've got Thando Mayeko on the line, who is with the latest PIC inquiry findings, and Dan Majila's testimony, which Pumi was very keen to get stuck into. But let's talk immediately to Thando. Hey, Thando, how are you?
Morning, Gareth. Morning to your listeners and everyone in the studio.
Sure. Thando has been keeping a keen eye on the Public Investment Corporation inquiry. Most recently, she covered Dan Majila's and that's the former CEO's testimony. She joins us on the line to give us some of the latest updates and her take on recent events. So what's happening? What did Dan say in his testimony?
So Mr. Majila, or rather Dr. Majila, has been in the hot seat for the past 3 days. Today will be his third day. And he is sought to paint a picture of him being a victim of political pressure. That's why the PIC has made so much questionable investment deals. Remember that the PIC handles around $2 trillion worth of money, of South Africans' money, mostly made out of pension funds and UIF. So most of those questionable deals include the PIC's 4.3 investment in AO Technology. Remember that AO Technology is owned by the controversial businessman Iqbal Survey. We know that the PIC also made investments in Edcon in a bid to save jobs that was one specific example that he, Dr. Jan Machila, made yesterday, which he says there was severe political pressure. And he made the suggestion that the shareholder, which is government, the biggest shareholder of the PIC, in the next round of in the PIC amendment bill, should not have such a big a role to play in the PIC, so that the next CEO and the next board of directors do not have to be influenced by any type of political agenda, whether from the ruling party or the finance minister or the deputy minister, because that negatively impacts on the investment strategies of the PIC and its developmental goals.
So tell me, Thando, obviously this sounds like a bit of a woe is me story from Dan. You know, when you made the CEO of the PIC and you have all this money that you have to try and manage so that people don't end up in poverty in their old age, because this is their money. You say that the shareholder is government, but effectively this is managing people's retirement. It's managing their pensions. It's money you take away from people and you put into investments which you hope will grow and will do better than inflation, so that these people don't have to eat dog food in their old age. This sounds like Dan, poor Dan, had such a tough time running this thing. He had so much pressure on him. Why was he in the job? Was he asked that question? Did anyone say to him, you know what, Dan, maybe you weren't strong enough to handle the pressures of this job? Maybe you didn't make the right decisions because you're too easily buckled under pressure. Did anyone say that to him, or was it just a chance for him to unburden himself?
So Dr. Dan has been very careful to make examples of deals where there is clear political pressure. One was the declined PIC investment in South African Airways, which he says there was political pressure from the then chairperson of the airline, Dudu Mweni, who is a close ally of former President Jacob Zuma. Of course, that was declined, but he says that Mweni was clearly unhappy with the decision. When asked by the assistant, the commission's assistant, Jill Marcus, on whether during any of these deals that had clear political pressure, whether he had sought legal advice or anything of the sort, he replied in the negative. He basically said no. When asked why, he said in hindsight, now he thinks that he should have asked for legal advice. So whenever he's been caught in a where he's been caught to be in the wrong, whether by the commission's assistance or by his own admission, he has admitted that he has been wrong. But those instances are few and far between. So, like I said, he really has painted a picture of himself as being the victim at the helm of the biggest state asset management company, a victim of political pressure. But the political pressure, he said, did not only come from the ruling party. We must remember, it came from across the board. He did not mention the party specifically because he was questioned by the other commission's assistant, Emmanuel Lediga, whether if he could name specific parties. The only specific party or members of the party he could mention were members of the ANC, but he did not say that the other parties did not pressurize him.
Yeah, like he would have listened. Like he would have listened to the EFF or the DA. Who's he trying to kid here? What's the guy think we're all morons?
Well, considering
yeah, we do know the ANC definitely, because the ANC president elects the finance minister,
right,
who in turn appoints the CEO of the PIC, and also the deputy finance minister is traditionally the chairperson of the PIC. So obviously,
correct,
he will first listen to...
he will only listen to... Pumi's got a question for you, Thando.
Thando, you know, I mean, you've been following the story for a while, and there are two names, and yesterday the one name has now kind of come out that I'm quite intrigued at how protected it has been. There's been lots and lots of talk over the past months as this thing has been unraveling of a certain woman whom Dr. Dan is accused to A, have had a relationship with, and also is the person who's been the key recipient in a lot of or person in the space. We hear a lot about Dudu Mweni, we hear a lot of names bandied around, but this particular individual is very well protected. Do you know who this person is and why she's so unnamed?
Yeah, Chief, can you come clean with this girlfriend story?
So the alleged girlfriend of Dr. Dan is a Ms. Pretty Low. She owns MST Technologies, and she has been the subject. She was the subject of this anonymous email by an anonymous whistleblower at the PIFB, who is now known as James Nogu. Now, James Nogu is unknown at this point. But he, around 2017-18, he released mass emails to the employees of the PIC. And in the emails, he alleged that the PIC CEO, well, the former PIC CEO, Dr. Dan, allegedly funded her business, which was an ailing business, a private business, through the CSI funds of the PIC. Now, yesterday, Dr. Jan made it clear that he had been cleared of all the allegations of first having a girlfriend by the name of Pretty Low, and secondly, of having funded Pretty Low's company through PIC's money. This report, he said, was compiled by senior counsel advocate Budlinger, and he says that it was well known that he had been cleared his name. The report had been given to the finance minister, but the finance minister had refused to take that into consideration. So he stood his ground. He said that he does not know who Ms. Pretty Low, his alleged girlfriend, is, and he does, and furthermore, he did not fund her through the PIC's money.
Wow.
And I mean,
I have a quick question now. He fingered Zwelin Mkhize yesterday.
Yes. So one of the most interesting things yesterday was when he was talking about the instances where he had political pressure from the ANC. So he says, at first, he said in his testimony, his written testimony, he said he received a request from a top politician, an unnamed top politician, to assist with funding the PIC's January 8th statement in 2016. Now, we do know that the January 8th statement of the ANC is a big bash. It sets the mood for the party for the whole year. And it basically, it is also a funding drive for the party. So he says that because he is unfamiliar with political party funding, and that the PIC does not fund political parties, he requested one of the companies that had benefited from the PIC to fund the ANC's bash on January 8th. So at first, during his testimony, he did not want to name who this top politician was. The words he used was like, "I'm not comfortable with naming the person." And then after the tea break, evidence leader advocate Yanni Liber came back, and he revealed that Dr. Dan was now comfortable with naming the politician, which was of course revealed as the current Minister of Finance and the former Treasurer General of the ANC, Dr. Zwelin Mkhize.
Health Minister. Yeah, he's Health Minister now, not Minister of Finance.
Oh, sorry, Health Minister. Yeah, Health Minister, Dr. Zwelin Mkhize. So Zwelin Mkhize, yesterday I tried to contact him and he was unavailable for comment.
You can always find him on Twitter, though.
So,
yeah.
Then after all, I mean, yesterday a lot was made of political pressure and how the PIC kind of needs to be insulated a little bit from some of this political pressure. And then as we go to bed last night, is Tito Mboweni is not tweeting about cooking pilchards, but rather about the new PIC board. Have you seen that board, and what do you make of it? And the fact that, as you mentioned, traditionally the deputy minister for finance is traditionally the chairperson of the PIC, but it's not so with this new board.
Definitely. That was one of the big surprises of the interim board that was announced by the finance minister, Mboweni. What he did do, though, if you see in the names, he included Labour representatives, one from the PSA and one from NEHAU. Other notable include people in the list include former ABSA chairman Maria Ramos and also Dr. Olani Nkwanazi, who Dr. Dan fingered as being one of the people who was part of former Finance Minister Manusi Gaba's appointees. He fingered Mkhwanazi as being at the heart of the potential capture by the Gigaba or potential capture of the PIC. So he was interesting interesting addition.
He's retained his seat because he was there before. So he's one of the two that have been reappointed.
Definitely.
All right.
Yeah,
well,
he's been one of the two that have been reappointed.
Tando, thank you so much for filling us in on some of those details. We've still got a lot of unpacking to do here. There's plenty to talk about. The whole thing, by the way, can we also stop calling him doctor, whatever? Unless you're a medical doctor, you don't get to use that title. If you have a PhD, you keep it to yourself. It really goes at the end of your name, not at the beginning. Let's stop calling this guy Dr. Dan. He's just Dan, and he's a failure. He's a complete and abject failure as a human being. He's run the PIC extremely badly, and he's cost South Africans their livelihoods in some cases. This is not a good person who we need to defer to or show any kind of respect. Am I wrong? I mean, doctor, let's call the doctor the guy who you... The doctor is the person that you put up front because he's the one who can save your life in a medical emergency, not PhD people.
Especially I just want to point out that my wife has a PhD.
I know you. You know what? I have
so
no
do
doubt.
You call her doctor?
You call her doctor when you're at home?
Sometimes.
Yeah. We
don't want to know.
We don't call PhDs doctors. We've got to stop doing this. Remember that whole fiasco when we found out that certain people in the ANC had fabricated their qualifications too? We're not even sure whether people have these things. Let's not get carried away by the right social sobriquets and titles. We're not into that in South Africa. Okay, so PIC set aside, because honestly, I don't know what else to say about this. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, but I think you can follow. Tando does a pretty much a live tweet from
awesome.
The place, so follow Hello Tando.
Excellent. Can I ask you guys about Marianne Tum and the EFF? Because this is something that I have been watching with some interest.
We spoke about this last week to some extent.
Give me a synopsis and whether there are any further.
The synopsis is there's been outrage around the fact that
she went through,
went through their trash. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that's a reasonable thing for a journalist to do.
Sure.
However, I also take the view that was expressed by Brendan Seary in terms of a piece that he wrote in The Citizen, that the story was actually lacking in journalistic integrity at a number of levels, because even though it was very clear that all of this stuff was found in the trash, drawing the conclusion that those were necessarily linked specifically to the EFF people who were staying there is not necessarily correct, because you can't draw a correlation based on the fact that
everyone in that hotel was EFF people. And
exactly.
Yeah.
So that's the first point. The second point, of course, is that the outrage around the fact that they spent 60,000 rand over the period of 4 days to hire the place. And then it turns out that there were actually four rooms, which actually sleep multiple people. And then if you divide it on a per-person basis, it actually becomes very reasonable when one compares it with the cost of a regular hotel. So... But crucially, the point for me is that the basics of going through the trash is completely acceptable, people, really. You know, once you put it out there, you know, people are going to go through it. We have these guys who
Another
come
way,
and
run. We must be one of the few places in the world where we turn on the whistleblower rather than actually absorb the story.
Exactly.
And in this case, what it is, even if it is at a much lower cost than Marianne is extrapolating from what she dug out of the trash, these guys are hypocrites. The EFF are a bunch of hypocrites. They talk about the poor. They talk about workers.
Well, yes, they are hypocrites. But in the context of this particular story, was it actually proved from a journalistic point of view that they, beyond reasonable doubt, that this was the EFF's and the dots were connected appropriately by Marianne in terms of the story? I don't necessarily believe that was the case. But so, does she have the right to go through the trash? Absolutely.
Sure.
You know, last week when we were talking about this, I was telling Sia about a fight that one of the tabloid newspapers had with... Oh God.
Wait, what's a tabloid newspaper?
All of them.
with Elizabeth Taylor. Yes. In the 80s, where someone did go through her trash and they also took a picture of her. And she bankrupted the paper because all she did was she sent them a bill for usage fees of using her image to say, I make a living out of my image.
Oh, wow.
And so she sent them an article and she sent them a bill to say, this is my fee and this is what it costs. Now that you've used my image, thank you very much. You owe me this amount of money. She bankrupted the paper. But, you know, I also tweeted that Brandon Siri article because I loved it so much, because it asked, you know, it asked questions that we all should be asking before we get angry, before we're tweeting and we're buying into this. So if you think that the EFF are hypocrites, then you know what? Just connect the dots. Show me what it is that makes you say these people are hypocrites. Mm. I'm not angry at you saying they are hypocrites. I'm not angry at you deciding to go through the trash. But just, it's, you know, we're not gossip mongering if we're going to be journalists. Can we make it a thing? One of the things that was also a very big thing was all of the, and then we become rabid about it. We become so emotional about all of these things. If you're just doing your job, don't be emotional about it. Just substantiate what it is that you're putting out there.
And also, I don't think you have to dig this deep to find, I mean, you just take a look at what, you know, the kind of outfits that some of these guys are wearing to the Durban July, and you don't need to be digging in their trash some of the time to see that there's hypocrisy. We know this is true for almost everybody in politics. They say one thing and they do another. They expect us to do one thing and they say another. That's just how politicians are. So hypocrisy is not unique to the EFF. I just think that it's very unfortunate that Marianne has been threatened with physical violence by supporters of the EFF.
This is
a real problem.
This is the issue where we should be actually showing real outrage against the EFF. Because the misogynistic bullshit that they come up with against people like Marianne, against people like Polly van Wyk, and this stuff is, to
they
my
are
mind, is
bullies.
They are bullies. It's clearly actionable.
And they are very quick to support, certainly they're not condemning violence against women, which we know is probably the single biggest social ill in South Africa. And they don't stand up and say, oh, this must stop, this is outrageous.
Well, actually, I think that men are bigger victims of violence than women, but let's just put that aside.
Wow. Very controversial point that you're just going to throw in and then duck out of. Explain.
Well, violence against women is a huge problem, but if you look in terms of who are the biggest victims of homicides, it's not women, it's men.
Yes.
So, you know, again, perspective.
Absolutely, but not necessarily related.
Yes.
The two have different origins and different circumstances.
Well, sometimes yes and sometimes no, and we don't actually have the ability to drill down between them. But the crucial point is that in terms of the way in which the EFF actually engages specifically with journalists, and in this particular case, it just so happens that the people who have been most assiduously following the story happen to be competent women. In this case, it's Marianne Tam and it happens to be Polly van Wyk. And their response has been to threaten violence. And it's really stuff that should be actionable from a parliamentary point of view. But of course, nobody is actually stepping up in parliament to say that the speaker needs to take action against the EFF for actually inciting violence outside of parliament. I think it should be open to censure in parliament.
Just a trick question for both of you. What, if anything, should be done to Zandile Gumede in Durban? She's now been criminally charged. Her supporters in Durban are saying she should hold on to her job. She's apparently reassuming office today after her suspension.
Well, I understand that the ANC has already said that she will not.
She's not resuming.
She will not take up her office.
Oh,
yeah. Look, I think the question that one needs to ask is that, you know, is she innocent until proven guilty? Well, the answer to that is yes. But given the sensitivity of the office that she holds, should she be allowed to continue to perform her duties? I think the answer to that is no. So, you know, basically, I think, you know, she's sent home with full pay until such time as the thing is resolved is the reasonable thing to do. But, you know, making assumptions in terms of whether she's guilty until the courts have had their say, you know, we shouldn't be doing that.
Fair enough. Pums, you want to add anything to that?
No, guys, you see, again, it's about this outrage. Like, as a country, we're just waiting for
it's
the next
drug.
Thing. We're waiting for the next thing to be outraged by. And even before it is necessary for us. We haven't applied ourselves, we haven't thought it through, we haven't asked the right questions or the relevant questions to see if we can justify our outrage. We're already foaming at the mouth.
But this is why Bell Pottinger did such a clever thing when they were hired by the Guptas. They did such a clever thing because they tapped into our real addiction, which is outrage.
Manufactured outrage, yes.
And Pumi, you've maybe been going on about this morning, but it is a big problem. We've got to examine why it is that we're so incendiary. Like, it doesn't take much to light South Africa up with outrage. And outrage itself has become some kind of a weapon. People feel that they're stronger when they can be more outraged. And just being outraged on its own is equivalent to nothing in terms of power.
Jeez, we're...
It's crazy, right?
Calm down, South Africa.
Cyril has said he wants to talk about Zim's energy woes. Do we really care about Zim's energy woes? We're paying for them in some way.
Well, they happen to owe money to Eskom, and really... Yeah.
$23 million.
Yes, because it was 33, but they've paid $10 million last week.
They've paid some. We saw the proof of payment.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the crucial question that that we really should be drilling down into is that it's not so much Zim's energy woes as much as the fact that it is Eskom's woes in general, and Eskom desperately needs money.
And what's happening there? I thought there was massive urgency. The president mentioned Eskom in his speech. Tito Mboweni's prioritized Eskom. Do we know how quickly they're moving to resolve the problems there, if at all?
They're not going to be able to resolve the problems there.
That's it.
Look,
it's just a basket case.
In 2023, when the carbon tax kicks in fully, there's going to be a couple of additional 100 million a year in terms of taxes that Eskom then becomes liable for. Our government is
so
stupid.
You know,
they don't have a clue in terms of how to run a country. And the sooner we get our heads around this, the better off we'll be. You know, I've been saying for years, if you want to actually solve the Eskom problem, go off grid. Let's talk about the Soweto debt issue. It's never going to be fixed.
Yeah.
Okay. Because at the point at which you try to enforce it, what's going to happen? Everyone out there is going to start rioting and government is going to back down. Here's how we fix Soweto. Go to every house that is currently illegally having electricity and give them solar panels. Give them solar panels. In other words, write off the money that it'll actually take to put in solar panels and batteries in every single household out there. Go in, put it in, and then take them off grid. Mm. And that's the way in which you'll fix it. Otherwise, it is always going to be a sinkhole. So,
you know,
treat it as a once-off cost.
As the Sowetan, the Sowetan debt issue. Grates my tits.
I don't want to picture that.
And for a number of reasons. I think it's again of the things that we create mass hysteria around, right? There are many municipalities across the country that have huge liabilities and debt to Eskom. But you know what? If we single out this one municipality and make this huge thing around it, instead of having a holistic conversation that says, so many of our municipalities are not paid, including City Power. City Power here in Johannesburg has its own issues with what they are not paying through to Eskom.
Pumi, so you're Eskom comparing issue, apples.
No,
you're comparing apples and oranges. The problem versus municipalities versus individuals who are stealing electricity on a month-by-month
and
basis.
And this is my municipal point.
The municipal debt can be recovered.
I'm not done.
But you're talking rubbish.
Hold on. You cannot decide that I'm talking rubbish until I have finished making this statement. And the point is, if we're going to have individual conversations about individuals and how much they owe, then we must have individual conversations about individuals and how much they owe. As you are saying,
we're
you
not
cannot
talking
compare
about what's
apples.
Owed. We're talking about ongoing theft. It's a different thing.
And I'm saying to you that if you were to take a fine tooth comb and look through all of Eskom's debts and say who owes Eskom what, you would have a serious conversation about Alexander. You would have a serious conversation about parts of Joburg, about Sandton, even, for crying out loud. You would have a conversation about organizations that owe Eskom money.
Here's what happens to me if I don't pay my electricity. I get cut off. and my electricity is costing me a fortune every month. It keeps going up. I just got an email the other day that it's going up 20% or something, out of the blue, just an extra 20% that I have to find. Now, if I don't pay, I don't get electricity. How come that doesn't apply to someone who lives in Soweto?
Why do you think that doesn't apply to people who live in Soweto?
Tell me why.
It happens. People get cut off all the time.
Pumi is talking rubbish.
I am a Soweto and I am telling you about an experience. Kenton's favorite
lived experience.
I am telling you about old people who pay their electricity bill every single month. When they don't, they get cut off. People get cut off in Soweto. Why do you think people don't get cut off in Soweto?
This is the streetlight effect. You know, you're familiar with the streetlight effect.
No, what is it?
The streetlight effect is that, a guy was staggering around at night and the cop comes up to him and the guy is clearly drunk. And the cop says, "What's going on?" And the guy says, "I'm looking for my car keys." And so the cop starts looking with him. And then the cop eventually says, where did you drop your keys? And he says, "Somewhere over on that side." And says, "Why are you looking here?" "Well, the light is out here."
Meaning?
Well, you see,
Looking at the lights in Soweto. We're saying Soweto doesn't pay its bills.
Pumi's problem is that she looks at it from the point of view of everyone in Soweto who legally pays their bill to City Power, and they continue to do so. Remember that Soweto is part of the Joburg municipality.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it goes through City Power. It isn't a question of the people in Soweto who regularly get energy bills. They are paying their bills. The problem is all of the part of Soweto that's uncharted. In other words, every single shack that has an illegal connection.
Yeah. Which is the majority of shacks.
That is the problem. Yeah. It is the illegal connections to the grid.
And those people are not paying.
And those are the people who are not paid. And one is not able to recover funds from them because they don't receive bills on a month-by-month basis because of the fact that they're illegal connections. But if the city of Joburg tries to terminate those illegal connections, there will be riots. And that is the issue that we are facing. It is not people like Pumi who live in Soweto who pay their bills on an ongoing basis.
But and yet what you hear is you hear Soweto does not pay its bills.
Yes, but
this is the problem that I'm saying. So you have demonstrated exactly the point that I'm trying to make. The point that I'm trying to make is that we have a collective conversation about something that is not essentially true. So there are lots of shacks in Ekurhuleni.
We had this conversation. I'm sorry, I'm still thinking about Pumi's tits my being great. I'm sorry.
But this is the point that I'm trying to make, is you have a conversation that says Soweto does not pay its bills.
Pumi has outrage about Soweto because, you know, she considers herself to be a child of Soweto.
She's manufactured her outrage this morning. Like she
was. But Kenton has made the point. If you're saying there are illegal connections,
the illegal connections in Soweto,
everybody in Soweto.
I'm going to accuse Pumi of whataboutism here because for her to like throw in Alex and Sandton and the city of Johannesburg, we know that we know the reason we're talking about Soweto is because they've done some studies into where the illegal connections are taking place, and there is a large volume of that that's happening in Soweto. So we have a finite area. We're able to ascertain out of that area how many people are and aren't paying. And clearly Soweto has a problem with paying. I'm not saying everybody on the individual level. There may be many good people
and again,
who are trying to pay.
Parts of Alex have a problem with paying. Because you look at the East Bank of Alex, I promise you everyone in the East Bank is actually paying for the electricity. But when you go into the interior of Alex.
But here we are now with Eskom being bailed out again by government to the tune of billions. And this comes from a situation where at some grassroots level, and look, don't let me get started on Eskom being mismanaged, because that's all it has been, is mismanaged. But there are people who are not paying. When you receive something and there is an expectation for you to pay it and you don't, it is theft. And that's what Canton's saying, which I can completely understand. Because if you don't pay yours, Pumi, at your house, or I don't pay mine, or Canton doesn't pay his,
we get cut off.
Boom, we get cut off. These guys just threaten to riot, and no one cuts them off. Now, that doesn't seem like an equitable situation to me.
Exactly. And the people who do that are based in Soweto overwhelmingly. In fact, if you take the amount of electricity that is stolen in Soweto on a daily basis, it is a multiple of hundreds of times what gets stolen in Alex. Electricity gets stolen in Alex. Remember, Alex will probably fit into Orlando Stadium. You know, it is so flippant tiny by comparison. Okay, Soweto is about the size of Israel.
It's a slightly mismatched metaphor, but yeah, we'll go with it. It's huge, right, for what it's worth.
Guys, all I'm saying is that when you create a situation where you say Soweto, the people of Soweto, and people work with people from Soweto, people are looking at side-eyeing you in the traffic, people looking at you
where
at work
you
thinking... Pimville, thank you very much.
Okay, so not Dobsonville.
Well, Graham says, and I think you've got to
but
take
this... But you
know
this, one unless you come from Indefire.
You've got to take this on the chin. Graham says, if you cry foul as a collective, then you have to get... scorned like a collective. Go down with the collective, I'm afraid. You know, if you're going to be proud Sowetan, you have to take the shit with the good. And then someone else says, it's July 2019. Why are we still talking about the rogue unit? It was fake news. The public protector is clearly compromised. Andrew. Yeah, I think we've covered that to the nth degree. Is there any other stuff in the news at the moment that's got your attention, Pumi Kanthan?
You wanted to talk about Sanrail. What was that
about? Oh, did we?
Oh.
Well, Fikile Mbalula is the new Minister of Transport, right? He made an announcement that Sanrail is due to spend 25 billion rand this year to expand the national road network. And in some places, that's a very good idea. We have to keep expanding the national road network. You know, there are some roads that we've been using now since the apartheid regime built them in 1963 and nothing's been done to them. Some of them need maintenance, but he's talking about expanding the road network to places that have dirt roads and sometimes not even that. That's a good thing, right? We should be in favor of that. That's money well spent, infrastructure.
Well, the starting point I'd like him to fix is to actually put up security and armed guards along the entire N3. Because remember,
those trucks that are being set alight.
The trucks that are being set alight. The entire subcontinent rolls on the N3.
Yeah.
Because all of the freight that lands in Durban and then goes up into sub-Saharan Africa, those trucks leave Durban. They head up to Zambia, they head up to Zimbabwe, they head up all the way to Dar es Salaam from Durban. And the entire fortunes of sub-Saharan Africa rest on that road. And we cannot have a situation where trucks are driving out there, they get pulled over, set on fire, and the drivers get shot because of the fact that they happen to be foreigners. And we are unable to enforce rule of law at that most basic level. Really, you know, I don't think that we should give a flying fuck in terms of whether there's a road that goes into Mooi Meisie or Broekiesfontein. Really, what we should be looking at is actually protecting the wealth of the country that is traversing the N3. Can we do this?
A road that goes where, Kenton?
Mooi Meisie or Broekiesfontein.
Wow.
So Makura and Mboweni were in a social media spat about e-tolls, which has led to Ramaphosa publicly calling them to order. David Makura is against e-tolls, wants them scrapped. Tito Mboweni says, hey, hang on, we've got sunken costs here, and someone has to pay for these roads.
Well, it's more than sunken costs. It's the fact that if foreigners are coming into our country and want to fund infrastructure projects, and if those infrastructure projects actually don't get paid for, then they're not going to come in and fund those projects. And yeah, it ties in. So that's the reason why we have to make sure that Eskom pays its debts. It's the reason why we have to make sure that Sanrail actually pays its debts. Makura is basically saying,
it's
well,
the reason Soweto has to pay its debts.
Well, that's theft. You know, that's not a legal debt. It's theft. But the point in terms of e-tolls, you know, there was a commitment that those roads be paid for. And if those roads are not paid for in that particular way, the money has to come from somewhere else. Now, you've already seen Mbalula saying that the backlog in terms of existing repairs to the national road network, forget about new roads, just maintaining the existing road infrastructure, the backlog is so absolutely massive that if we were to increase the fuel levy by some massive amount of money, like probably about, you know, 50 cents, it would take us the next 20 years to pay it off.
Sure. So something has to be done.
Yes. So, but I'm saying that the e-tolls bill has to be paid. And the way in which it gets paid, either we are going to have the people of Gauteng actually paying e-tolls.
Doesn't look likely.
Which it's unlikely because it's unenforceable. You know, it's exactly the same as the Soweto electricity thing. Mm. If you simply take down all of those toll gantries and actually put up actual toll gates, suddenly people are going to pay.
Yeah, because you can't get through.
You can't get through them otherwise, because when we go down to Durban...
I know. Have you seen the traffic?
Yes. When we go down to Durban, we actually pay on a regular basis, because that's the only... Well, it's the quickest way to get down to Durban. Otherwise, you have to take all of the side roads, which, you know, are riddled with potholes, and you're taking your life into your hands.
I can't imagine actual toll booths being set up on the N1. It's bad enough. It moves as slowly as it's possible to move.
Well, that is, but that is the alternative. Yeah, and I find it ridiculous that, you know, people, the idea why we refuse to pay for e-tolls is entirely because of the fact that we can. It's like TV licenses.
But you don't see it as just another stealth tax. I mean, it is something that we have bills. You've got to pay your bills.
There's a lot of misinformation that goes out around e-tolls. For example, one of the things is that it's too expensive. Actually, the percentage that goes to the toll collection agency is 18%, okay, which is pretty much an average sales commission if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest, so out of every rand, you have 18 cents that's going to the toll collection agency and 82 rand that is flowing back to SANRAL. But ultimately, the debt in terms of the cost of actually funding those roads is the responsibility of SANRAL. And if that 82 cents on the rand is not flowing to SANRAL, then that money is accumulating. That debt, the interest keeps piling up, and ultimately the country has to pay for it. And I feel very strongly that we as the people of Gauteng should be paying for those roads. We shouldn't be imposing that cost on the people of Durban and the people of Cape Town.
Yeah, we use them.
Yes, much as I think that the people of Cape Town and the people of Durban are basically leeches on our economy in any case, but let's just get them outraged this morning.
All right, so loads
we're
of
manufacturing outrage. Yeah,
everybody,
and
there's
it
so much for you to get outraged by today. I'm delighted to offer you so many things that you can get outraged by. And we will be back with another Burning Platform next Thursday, bright and early. It's a must-have. You put it in your diary. Make a calendar note and put it on repeat every week, because that's what we do. The Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's. Thank you, Canton. Thank you, Pumi. And we will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9 o'clock.
This is CliffCentral.com.